You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Well, there's nothing in the NBA that draws quite as well as its biggest rivalry, the Celtics and the Lakers. And on Saturday, it was the most watched regular season NBA game outside of Christmas Day in 7 years, with, of course, all the caveats about out-of-home viewing. And welcome back to the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, joined as always by Armon Brody. Please subscribe on the SMW podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. And we'll just get started with the NBA talk because, obviously, big numbers for Celtics Lakers. It's not necessarily, you know, a surprise given the matchup, given the trade the Lakers made for Luka Doncic, and given the fact that, you know, they were at the time in second place in their respective conference. But given all the narrative about NBA ratings this season, certainly an encouraging number for the league, 4.6 million. I think the first game between them this year was, I mean, TNT, you know, late window, 10 o'clock. I think it was like 1.something million. That was also the night when Heat Bucks was delayed. So the scheduling was a little bit odd for that game, but certainly a lot better than that first meeting. And again, the best regular season NBA audience outside of Christmas since 2018, with again, the caveats about out of home viewing. Armand, what do you think? Do you take this as a sign of the NBA strength, or is it really, as it's been so often over the years, the strength of LeBron against his big rivals?
That's exactly what I think it is, the latter, John. Lakers good equals NBA good, just like Cowboys good equals NFL good, just like Yankees good equals MLB good. Add to that one of the greatest players of all time in LeBron James, then Luka Doncic. There's so much intrigue and there's still a curiosity about how they're going to look as we move towards April and the playoffs. And then the fact that the Boston Celtics have consistently been, over the last few seasons, one of the best teams in the NBA. All the ingredients were there. This is what ABC had in mind when they jumped headfirst with this Saturday primetime package. They had games like this in mind. And good for them that they got this kind of a situation where all the ingredients were cooked together to produce this kind of number for ABC and ESPN. I know they're thrilled about it. But yeah, you get LeBron, you get Luka, you get the Lakers who are surging. You get all these, this perfect mixture of everything that's got to come together. And then there's the historic Lakers-Celtics rivalry, the mystique and the aura going back to the 1980s and Bird and Magic and Kevin McHale and all of the great characters from the 80s that made that rivalry so great. You put all of that together and you get the kind of outcome that we got. I'm really glad. There was a lot of intrigue going into the game. Felt big. It felt important. And I think the viewership numbers proved that out.
What do you think about Celtics Lakers getting 4.6 million on the same weekend that Denver OKC gets, you know, 1.9? I mean, what does that say?
It says that there's still a bit of a gap, I think. And it says that there's not enough of the casual fan being aware of how good, particularly Oklahoma City, because they feel like an up-and-coming team, but they're actually the best team in the Western Conference. That's the confusing part. And so I think it says that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has not quite moved to that superstardom level for the casual fan to be as aware of him. And I guess Denver's three-time MVP, three times, right? I think he's won it three times. Nikola Jokic, I don't think there's enough of that superstardom, that mega stardom with him for the casual fan yet. But if they keep winning like this, and if you get some really intriguing playoff matchups, you get some 6-7 game series, things could be a bit different, but still feels like there's a bit of a gap there in terms of popularity for the casual fan for Denver, Oklahoma City compared to LeBron James and the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, you know, the NBA, I mean, I'm not going to boil it down to, oh, the Lakers and Warriors weren't good to start the season, but now they are, and that's why ratings are recovering. I think ratings were recovering even before the trades, for example. But obviously, you can't deny having LA and Golden State be relevant and good is significant for the league. I mean, obviously, it's not necessarily a clean bill of health for the NBA, right? I mean, the league is basically kind of, you know, on the mend, and it's certainly not dying out, but, you know, the cholesterol is still a little high, you know what I mean? And to me, I think, you know, you'd have a cleaner bill of health if you were getting $2.9 million for Denver OKC and $3.6 million for Lakers Celtics, right? So, you know, you're not going to be able to count on this 40-year-old man, LeBron James, forever. And you're not going to be able to count on Stephen Curry at 36 forever either. And it's a matter of tremendously good fortune that either of these two guys are in position to contend. And eventually, you know, the NBA needed to start moving away from LeBron and Steph, you know, from dependence on those two guys in 2018, which, by the way, happens to be the last time the league had a larger regular season audience than this year. You know what that game was? LeBron versus Boston. He was in Cleveland at the time. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's great for the NBA. And obviously, you know, with all the underhanded talk about the league, just kind of all the ways in which certain people have been going out of their way to paint the most negative picture that they possibly can, it's good for the league. I think it'd be better for the league if you had a few, you know, a little bit fewer viewers for Lakers Celtics and a lot more for Denver OKC.
That's fair. And I know we've talked on this podcast and there's been so much conversation about how the league is covered. But I do think there needs to be more of an effort on the broadcasters, the networks themselves, to let people know how great these teams are. Besides just the Lakers and the Celtics, I do think there's a responsibility. Introduce us to Oklahoma City and keep doing it. Keep feeding us a steady diet. Keep giving it to us. Keep telling us how great Denver is. Keep driving those points home, because if you tell the viewers that a team is great, you tell the viewers that a team carries some weight, eventually they will start to believe you, especially when they're showing this consistent success and this dominance in their conference. So hopefully there's some sort of a wake-up call here that's going to hit at some point. I think it has to, where the network, the partners start saying, you know what, let's start pushing a little bit more to make sure people are as aware of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, as aware of Nikola Jokic, as they are a LeBron James, as they are a Boston Celtics as a franchise, a Jason Tatum perhaps, or Jaylen Brown. Let's do those things to make sure that there are more eyeballs and there is more interest in a Denver, Oklahoma City as there is an LA Boston.
Yeah, and you know what's really important? Don't just talk about Denver and OKC and Cleveland when you are trying to bash the Lakers or bash, you know, the Warriors or whatever. And this is kind of aimed at one person, right, Chuck? Like, talk about them in their own context. Have a conversation about them that does not involve your grievance about LeBron James. So to me, I think that is very important. These teams need to be discussed independently of whatever problem you have with the big market team.
That's such a great point. Praising Cleveland should not mean destroying the Lakers. Praising Oklahoma City should not mean bashing Boston. There has to be just an appreciation for what these teams bring to the table on their own, by their own merit. Look at what these teams have. Look at the talent. Look at the coaching. Look at the decisions that have been made by the front office and judge these teams accordingly. Because if you keep doing that, eventually the viewers will start to wake up and see things from your point of view. The media does not realize sometimes, or maybe they don't take advantage. They don't take proper advantage of the way they can affect how viewers see teams and players. And I think a lot of times it ends up being perverted when really there can be a lot of good done. You can take that platform you have, those podcasts, those TV shows, the Inside the NBAs and the Countdowns, and you can really let people know over and over and over and over again, Oklahoma City's really good. Denver's really good. And it doesn't have to have anything to do with how bad the Lakers are. They're just good on their own.
Exactly. And that kind of isn't necessarily how things are done in TV, though. Maybe back in the 90s, you know, NBC would have had OKC on at least maybe a couple of times in one of their little triple headers back then. But, you know, it's interesting to have this discussion because, of course, on our episode today, we have someone who is part of the NBA media. We are very pleased to be joined by George Sedano of ESPN, who gave us a full hour of his time. And we do talk about some of these issues with NBA media coverage, but we also talk about his career. We talk about his forays into play-by-play, some of his inspirations. But we start by talking about the show he is on so often on ESPN, Around the Horn, which is ending, of course, in May. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to step aside and play for you this interview that we conducted today, Tuesday. We're taping Tuesday. And then after that's done, we'll come back and wrap things up.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now. And support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
All right. Well, we are very happy to be joined today by George Sedano of ESPN. George is joining us today fresh off the set of NBA Today. George, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the pod and love to chat with you.
All right. Hey, you know, obviously the big story right now in sports media, certainly as pertains your on-air presence, is the looming end of Around the Horn. This was announced, I believe, last week. It's going to end on May 23rd. Just your thoughts on the show and, you know, obviously I'm not going to ask you, you know, what you think of the decision, but just what are your thoughts on the legacy that Around the Horn will leave behind when it goes off the air?
Well, I think it was certainly a show that was unique in its presentation. I think the fact that it opened so many doors, launched so many careers, if you think back to its, you know, inception back in 2002, and it really started with taking sports writers and sports columnists specifically and putting them on television, which was still sort of a novel concept. We had the sports reporters that would air on the weekends. You know, with Dick Schaap, obviously a very famous show. And, you know, if you got the call to that show, I mean, that was huge for anyone at that time in the newspaper industry. But this kind of became that on a daily basis, at least initially. And then later on, it expanded to people beyond print. And, you know, which I kind of got in loosely because I haven't written in a long time, but I did write a lot of features for ESPN.com over several year span. So that's what ended up getting me on the show. Back 7+ years ago. But yeah, to me, the legacy is that is like it became a who's who of sports media pundits on television. And there's just so many people from so many different walks of life, both personally and professionally, that have appeared on that show. And to me, that's its legacy, is that it launched so many careers. And if it didn't launch their careers, it certainly expanded those people's careers.
You know, Armand and I were talking about Around the Horn on the podcast last week. One of the conclusions that we reached was, even though it is the show that scores the argument, right? That was the original tagline.
It's really not a debate show. There's not a lot of yelling. There's not a lot of acrimony. It's fairly, you know, congenial. And I was wondering your thoughts. Do you think that kind of maybe put it at a disadvantage in a more combative sports media space?
Well, I think initially it was very much that, okay? You know, because you had Gina Mariotti and Woody kind of going at it. I do think it was certainly more cordial than the stuff we see on sports television today and still the case. But you know what? You get me and Frank Isola on the same set. We're going to take some jabs at each other. It's not the overt yelling and screaming at each other. First of all, there's just not enough time with that many people and you're taping a 22-minute show and you're trying to squeeze in as many topics as possible. So I think that played a that certainly plays a role in how it differentiates itself in regards to the rest of the landscape. And because it's four people on a panel plus Tony, I think that that certainly creates some differences between the rest of kind of the landscape for sure. But to me, you know, I loved kind of the quick-wittedness. It taught you to be brief and efficient on a lot of different subject matters, which isn't easy. And what I think people don't know, and, you know, I'll convey it here, is the work and the effort that takes place behind the scenes. First of all, you get this package of potential topics that's as thorough as anything I've ever received in the 12 years I've been at ESPN. The conference call is twice as long as what we do to tape the show. So everyone is going through their thought process on each individual topic, while, by the way, Aaron Solomon, who is the main producer on the show, is kind of catching everyone up because, for example, like me on the West Coast, or like Mina Kimes or Bill Plaschke, I mean, we're just waking up when this conference call is happening. So yes, we've seen everything, but we may have missed something on the East Coast and vice versa, by the way, for the people on the East Coast, they may have missed something on the West Coast and didn't get a chance to catch it in full. He'll give you a brief summary. Then you've got several hours to really focus in and catch up on the topic at hand. So I love that aspect of it. And the one thing I will give Around the Horn and PTI, I think those are the two shows that do the best job of this, is that they will tackle every single sport when they're in season. We will talk NHL during the NHL season. We will talk college hoops, men's and women's during that particular season. It's not just an NFL show or an NBA show. We'll talk a lot about Major League Baseball, certainly when the time comes. And, you know, I think that I take a lot of pride in the fact that there weren't a lot of other shows and still aren't a lot of shows on the network that will expand kind of the scope enough that Around the Horn was willing to do that and also have some fun, right, while they do it as well. It wasn't always, to your point earlier, just sitting there and just trying to shout each other down.
So, George, when was your first episode? What do you remember about that day?
So, October 2018? Yeah, that sounds right. So, the best part of this, and I'm actually going to, so this will be a little tease, on May 23rd, on the last episode, I was going to tweet this out and also put it on my Instagram. And I'm not the only one that's received this, but Tony sends you a message before you're on the show. And by the way, this is letting you know, hey, you've been selected to be on the show. And I don't know when this tradition started, but I know Tony has done it for a long time. So all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you get this text. And in mine, it was a video of Tony. It's Tony kind of, you know, pumping you up and saying, hey, it's reality. And I'm here for the full Sedano experience on Around the Horn, baby. Let's go. And, you know, he's just being Tony. And that's the other part of the equation. People have obviously seen what kind of personality Tony is. He is literally one of the nicest human beings I've ever come across. And that can't be more, it can't be said enough, in my opinion, because this is a business of, it can be cutthroat, let's just say, okay? And Tony is the most inviting person I've ever worked with on any project at ESPN or even before ESPN. So I think that that is just like, it's so him that he would do that, that he would send you this greeting to welcome you to this crazy little wacky family that he has, that to me, that always sticks out. But as far as the show, yeah, you're nervous as hell because, again, it moves fast. Like, if you are not ready to go, you can't stumble. Because if you stumble, you know, the next person's going. Like, they're muting you, the next person's going, and you're done for that particular topic. So, and here's the other part that most people don't realize. You don't want to be the person that fumbles so bad that we have to stop the taping and start over again. Because we're filming this A block, and it's the longer block. It's 12 to 13 minutes. And you don't want to be the one, while we're all sitting there, we all have stuff to do, right? To be the one to bust and us having to then start over again, right? So I think there's a semblance, particularly in the A block, that you want that to happen. So luckily, I think that's only happened in my 8 years, like 2, maybe 3 times. Everybody does it at one point or another, but you don't want to be the guy that keeps people there any longer than you need to. So yeah, to me, I remember being nervous as hell, but Tony just does such a great job on your first appearance of settling you in, giving you 30 seconds to tell people who you are, you know, and I remember just talking about my, like a quick elevator pitch of my resume and how long I'd been at ESPN and what I'd done. And then Tony will personalize it, like saying, like, you know, my kids' names, he's husband to the, to my wife, you know, father to these two kids. And it just, it really makes you feel at ease, even though you are nervous on that first show.
What is the experience like the first time you get muted?
You're probably a little annoyed, I got to be honest with you. Because you're like, wait, I thought I was making a great point. And it could be, you know, you messed something up, you botched a stat or a fact, or it could just be, hey, we're running too long, you got to shut up, and the next person's got to go.
Yeah, and I've always thought that every now and again, you can tell there's some genuine irritation when people find themselves muted. You know, obviously, it's been 23 years, there's only, I think, only one person who's been there the entire time, including Tony, because Tony wasn't there at the beginning.
Right, and Max was the original host, right?
Yeah, that would be Woody Page, who was literally, I remember watching that first episode, he was on that first episode. Obviously we saw last week a tribute to Woody on the air. I'm sure you're going to say something to Woody when you're on the show with him next time, but just some thoughts on Woody Page.
Man, a pioneer. Like when I was young watching this show in 2002 when it first started and in the early aughts, I wanted to see what Woody had on his board. That was really the thing I wanted to see every day. Beyond the sports commentary, I always thought whatever he had up there was going to be hilarious. And yeah, I've done so many shows over the years with Woody. And Woody he's prickly at first. He wants to make sure, hey, rookie, you're here. I'm here to win. You know what I mean? Like there is a competitive nature to this. Like nobody likes to lose. I think we are good sports about it, but there is some occasional ribbing on and off camera and some, again, some quick-witted fun is what I would say, and good-natured ribbing back and forth. But yeah, I've had so much fun with Woody over the years. And again, like you're talking about 23 years on television for the show and for him is just, you just don't see that, right? So the fact that he has been there from day one and will be there, I'm assuming, on that last show, and I'm not trying to break news, I don't know, but I'm assuming that would be the case. It would only be apropos. You know, is an incredible run for him, for the show, for the entire cast and everyone. But yeah, I guess the times I've had the most fun with Woody is on the Halloween shows. I've done the last 3 Halloween shows, and you know, Woody is just a hoot, man, on those shows.
What's your favorite costume, George, from the Halloween shows?
That I've worn or that someone else has worn?
That you wore.
Okay, so I did, the first year I did Scott Hansen of Red Zone. Last year, or 2 years ago now, I did Pat McAfee. and then I did Chris Russo. Now, the costume was way more, like there went way more went into being Pat McAfee, right? Like I had like kind of like the beard, like the light beard. They dyed my hair blonde. I had the tank top on with the chain and the watch. And the set was different in my studio, you know, to mimic what he has. And then I had to talk like this, a little hoarse the whole show. And the McAfee one was probably my masterpiece, right? But I won with Scott Hansen because of my... just my delivery, even though I don't look like Scott Hansen, just my delivery was pretty spot on. So much so that I got connected via text. My guy, Dave Pash, who does play-by-play on ESPN television, he's friends with Hansen, and he put us on a text message right after the show aired, and we went back and forth, and he was great. And then, you know, so McAfee was probably the one that was the best. Although the one I had the most fun doing was the last one, and I didn't win. I was going for a three-peat, which I would have been in rare air going for a three-peat, even though back-to-back is still pretty hard. But it was Chris Russo. I was Chris Russo this past Halloween. And I'll tell you what, I thought I did a pretty good job, Stevie. I don't know, they ripped it off. I got ripped off on that one. And I had the hair and, you know, whatever. And I was like, my tie was all disheveled as we went through the show. I had the most fun doing that one. But yeah, my masterpiece was definitely McAfee.
Wow, that was quite the impression. You know, you want to do a little Scott Hansen for us?
Hold on. I have to go. It's been a minute. So I'm not in football season, right? So I think that, give me a second. So it was more like, it's just more like very direct delivery. It's like, let's go to the Octobots here. We have, you know, it's time for the, it's time for the witching hour. Let's go Octobots here as the Cleveland Browns are finding their way to come back against the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Now that's really good. That's better than the, Russo.
Oh, see, I don't know. I still think, that we can agree to disagree.
We can disagree. We can agree to disagree. I'll tell you that, okay? I still think my Chris Russo is A+. So much so that they put it on First Take the next day, and Chris Russo said, Sedano, A+.
Well, I don't even know how to respond. That's excellent. That's excellent.
That is a true story. They ran it for Chris the next day on First Take. And Stephen A. and Molly and him and everybody was laughing. They were falling on the floor laughing.
Well, it's interesting. You know, this is a show that gives you the opportunity to show so much of your personality. Whereas, obviously, there's just not a lot of those opportunities generally in sports broadcasting. Now, you, of course, do radio.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that gives you an opportunity to kind of tap into your personality a little bit there. But, you know, one of the things I've been interested in, we're seeing a trend away from what happened in the early 2000s and before with the sports reporters. A lot of, you know, sports journalists getting to be TV personalities. We're moving away from it. Do you see that being something that will eventually be lost where, you know, it's going to be, you know, Stephen A. obviously was a journalist turned into a broadcaster. But for the most part, it's going to be the McAfees, ex-players, not necessarily journalists going forward.
I mean, I think it could be cyclical. You know what I'm saying? I think it just depends. Who's someone that can break through in a way that resonates, right? Or could be polarizing, right? And I think that those are the qualities you want. And in this direct-to-consumer world, I think that is going to be, like, you have to have a real draw in some way, shape, or form. I still think that, clearly, look, we've already seen this in audio, basically. Direct-to-consumer has been... is basically podcasts, right, in the audio world. And we've seen people have tremendous amounts of success, whether that's Bill Simmons or Dan Le Batard after his departure from ESPN. And, you know, Dan obviously had an incredible following at ESPN, and so did Bill. So I think that, to me, it's just about who would resonate. I don't think it's one side or the other, whether it's an athlete or a journalist or a former journalist. I just think it's who resonates and who cuts through. And look, some of that is also subjective. It's who is able to get that platform and who do they believe in on that platform that can generate that kind of audience. So, you know, to your point earlier, to me on radio, I've been doing radio for over 20 years. And it's, to me, it's the most fun format because I can explore the space in a way that I can't do on television because television is bite-sized for the most part. And when I started at ESPN, I started as a radio guy that ended up doing all those talk shows. I was the Stephen A. and Skip fill-in. I was the fill-in for Mike Greenberg on Mike and Mike. I was the fill-in for Cowherd when he was there because I was, at the time, you know, I think Doug Gottlieb had already left. So I was like the only one that could do a solo talk radio show that was left in that particular lineup. Everybody else was either paired, had sidekicks or whatnot. But that was what I grew up doing anyway. In the business. So for me, it was very natural to do that. I wouldn't want to do it now. I don't do it now because it's just a lot of work. And even Cowherd doesn't do it now. He's got a sidekick, right? Like everyone's kind of got that. You know, I have a co-host, Scott Kaplan, who I enjoy working with on 710 ESPN in Los Angeles. And I just love the ability to explore the space. But to me, the direct-to-consumer model is going to be about who can get the most eyeballs to them. And I think whether that's podcasts has already kind of started that, and YouTube, obviously. And that's what people are going to be drawn to. And that's who's going to get those type of platforms. And really, as we all know, it's really just, if you're going to do it on linear television, it's just a bridge to the games, because that's really where the money is made and where the eyeballs really are.
George, you mentioned radio, and it seems to be a bit of a lost art now, but explain to our listeners just the importance of radio and how it can set you up for success in other areas of your career.
Oh, there's no question. Without radio, I would not have been as successful or natural at adjusting to television. Because here's what I'll tell you. On television, you can be in a studio and the prompter can go out like that. And then you're naked, basically. Okay. Figuratively, obviously. And you've got to be able to go. And not everybody can do that, is what I'll say. And I'm not really speaking to anyone here at ESPN. I'm just saying, like, I worked very briefly in local television in Miami before I came to ESPN. And to me, I noticed that writing in the prompter was not something I wanted to do. I wrote shorter and then went more ad lib, but would tell, like, the producers, because they need to know a point to then roll a video or a piece of sound. And I would tell them, I'll hit this cue and then you can roll it, you know? So we kind of worked it that way. And here at ESPN, like, I just did NBA Today, to your point. I will have the producers write the script. Then I come in the earlier and I'll just tweak it to my voice. And sometimes if we're running behind because somebody was talking too long, you know, they know how to follow me at this level. At the network level, the people producing these things, they understand sometimes you're going to have to skip around and do what you need to do. But yeah, I just think that radio has allowed me the ability to feel comfortable in my own skin, the ability to ad-lib, which happens constantly in my role, particularly on games, whether it's on play-by-play, which is a more recent venture for me, but certainly on the sidelines. Like, when I've been doing sidelines, particularly in those interview settings, when you're interviewing a coach or a player, you got to be ready to go in an instant. Like, you have to be quick on your feet. And it's funny because Dan Le Batard and I go way back, and for years, he would kind of trash the sideline reporting as an industry and like a job. And I was like, Dan, you have no idea how much harder that job is than almost anything that people do on a broadcast. First of all, you're like a wide receiver in football. You got to hope the ball's coming your way, right? You got to try to get the ball thrown to you. And then when the ball's thrown to you, you better catch it and you better finish the play. You know what I'm saying? And you only have a finite amount of time to get all that in there, because it's not like you're allowed to, and understandably so, because the game is the reason you're there. You've got to nail this in 30 to 40 seconds. So to me, that job, having to be on your toes so much, is all radio, because it's rare when I do a sideline hit that I've scripted anything. It's okay, I've got this one topic I want to talk about. Let's just say Steph Curry, for example, right? Steph Curry's about to hit 4,000 threes. You know, I will come out of the gate and say, hey guys, welcome back here to San Francisco. Steph Curry, 2 3-pointers away from 4,000. He'll be in a class of his own. When I spoke to Steph earlier about the feet, he said X, Y, and Z. Then I talked to Steve Kerr prior to the game, and he marveled at Steph's ability to hit threes in this way, shape, or form, et cetera. You know, guys, so we're on 4K watch here for Steph. Back to you, right? But I didn't write any of that down. I remembered what Steph told me briefly. I remember what Steve Kerr told me briefly. I set up what we're talking about, and I sent it back to the guys. To me, I'm a minimalist, okay? Because if I sit there and I start reading something to you, first of all, you can tell I'm reading, number one. Second of all, I only think there's so many numbers people can digest, right, when they're listening to a broadcast. So unless there's support graphically, like, you probably shouldn't be going into, like, offensive rating and defensive rating unless there is the ability to support it with graphics on the screen. So for me, radio has taught me, A, how to be efficient, and B, in a blowout situation, how to be able to help my partners when the game is a 40-point blowout and they run out of things to talk about, and I can sit there and help tee them up and get them going. But then in the interview settings, as I mentioned, you never know what's going to happen. I'll give you the perfect example. It's pinned on my Twitter feed. It's still the most famous interview I've ever done in-game. Greg Popovich. So I'm in Toronto, DeMar DeRozan's return game. So this is when Kawhi was traded for DeMar. So it's 2019. And I'm doing the game with Mark Jones and Doris Burke. And I'd already done a pop game earlier that season, but it was against Houston. But we have a rule. Here's a little behind the curtain. We have a rule on the sidelines. If it's 20 points or more, the interview's off. Nobody has to do the interview, whether you're winning or losing in that scenario, because it's really like a silly thing. Like, what, you're just going through the exercise at that point. There's nothing to really talk about in that scenario. So the first time I had them earlier that year was against the Rockets, and they were down 21, so I didn't have to talk to Pop. So, but prior to that game, he's unbelievable, and he would probably hate to hear this because he doesn't want anybody praising him. But and by the way, I hope if Pop does find a way to listen to this, I hope he's doing a great job in recovery because we can't wait to see him again. But he's unbelievable in those settings, in those pregame meetings that we do, those production meetings that are 15 or 20 minutes long. And I remember Mike Breen telling me that Rockets game, saying like, hey, don't let him fool you. When he goes out there, he's not that guy. And then, so I'm doing this game in Toronto, and it's me, Jonesy, and Doris in this production meeting with him. And at that time, Toronto, as you know, with Kawhi, they were jumping out on teams. They were so good that year. So Doris, I believe, asked Pop, like, hey, you know, they've been prone to jump out early on teams. What are you going to do if that happens? Like, what are you going to do to settle your team down? It's like, oh, I'll probably just call timeout and I'll just curse them out or whatever. And, you know, we all start laughing. And she goes, yeah, and then poor George has to interview you. And he goes, yeah. And then I'll look at you and be like, what kind of bleeping question was that? So we're all laughing. Ha, ha, ha. We walk out of the room. Doris says, don't buy that for a second. He will chew you up and spit you out once that camera gets on because he hates that interview. So I get out there and I ask him first question in Toronto, Pop, DeMar DeRozan's return game, lots of emotion. How do you feel he's fared here in the first quarter? And Pop gives me a very Pop-like answer and says, I think he's done well. And I look at him and I say, okay, how about I come out ahead here and we just skip the second question? And he looks at me and he smiles and then he looks up and he looks at me again and he goes,
I was looking forward to a second question.
And I kind of stumbled through this. I'm kind of trying not to laugh. And I'm stumbling through the second question. Like, well, Derek White makes his return off of injury. How do you think he's fared, you know, off the injury? And he goes, I think he's done well, too. And I go, all right, Pop, thanks. And he goes, yeah, that was fun. I said, yeah, we should do it again sometime. He slaps me on the butt and keeps it moving. And I tossed it back to Jonesy and Doris. And they were howling with laughter on this broadcast. I'm not joking. I received easily 200 text messages within a few minutes of that interview. And that thing went super viral back then at that time. Radio taught me to have that interplay and allow myself to flourish in the sideline role. And of course, it helps you in the play-by-play role as well for a number of different reasons.
Well, you know, to that point, you are doing play-by-play now. Any number of broadcasters over the years have jumped from the sideline to game analysis or studio hosting or play-by-play. I know one of the recent folks to do it, Michael Brady, is great on the Nets sidelines. And you know,
yeah, my guy. He's our colleague here at ESPN as well. Yeah.
Yeah, he seems to be a real up-and-comer. And, you know, for you, I know it's been primarily college football. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but I recall you doing some NBA Summer League on play.
Yes, right. And I've done NBA games on ESPN Radio. So I've done that, called a couple playoff games last year on ESPN Radio, including a clinching game in Dallas. When they beat OKC in the second round. And then I switched the sidelines for the conference finals and the finals on radio. But yeah, this will be year three of college football on ACC. And the first year, man, like, I know what a good broadcast sounds like. I've worked with some of the best people in the business, right? Mike Breen, Dave Pasch, Mark Jones, Ryan Rucco, leading up to that opportunity. And I will tell you this, it was a daunting experience the first couple of games. And it's not that I didn't feel like I didn't know how to call a game. It's just college football is daunting. There's 85 scholarship players on both sides. And by the way, once you get into a blowout scenario, which happens more than you think in college football, your depth chart does not reflect who is coming in the game. So you've got to be ready to go storytell. And by the way, storytell in a way that lands the plane usually in like 10 or 15 seconds, because teams play so fast now with no huddle for the most part across the board and on a lot of these teams that it is a real art form. I've been so fortunate, though, that I could pick the brains of the four guys I mentioned already. Noah Eagle was incredibly instrumental helping me out. And, you know, he and I, because he lived here in L.A. for a while doing Clippers games. And it's funny because someone asked me, like, wow, he's so much younger than you. I'm like, yeah, but he's so much better than me and so much better than I'll ever be. Like, why wouldn't I pick that guy's brain? And, you know, I'm trying to think who else. Sean McDonough gave me some great advice. He said to me, because I said to him, what do you think the biggest transition will be for me going from radio? Because I'd done some radio play-by-play, obviously NBA and even college football and NFL, 2 years prior to doing it on TV. Honestly, I did that at the behest of Mike Breen, who said, if you really want to learn to do this, you want to learn and have a good foundation on how to call games, you got to start on radio, because you got to describe every blade of grass on the field. You got to describe every inch on the court, when you're calling a basketball game. And he's right. I had a good base based on that. It was just kind of learning the artistic form of doing it on television, to which Sean said to me, you know, no one's ever complained that the broadcaster didn't talk enough. And he's right. He's absolutely right. So you got to learn to lay out. You got to learn to let it breathe. So that way, when you do talk, it's impactful and the audience perks up when you're at home. Because I know I do it. It's a natural thing. So he was so helpful. Adam Amin, who is my colleague here at ESPN, also helpful. John Bugshambi, who's been a dear friend for 25 years. Kevin Harlan, incredibly helpful as well. There's so many people that I've just been able to pick up the phone. And because they're fans of my work, and I've met them along the way in one way, shape, or form, that they were willing to give me the time of day to kind of pick their brains, that it just was really a humbling experience, because they were like, you know, man, I'm a big fan of what you do on the sideline. This is going to be awesome for you. You know, like, and I was able to pick their brains in a way that allowed me to kind of get through it. So after about like my fourth game, I started to feel more and more comfortable. And, you know, I did okay, I thought, after my head was spinning for a while the first year. And then last year, I was comfortable pretty much the whole way. Like, I felt incredibly in control of the game. I think there's still one aspect that I feel like, and this was some piece of feedback I got from one of my bosses, which was incredibly helpful. Mike McQuaid, who's now in charge of events, gave me, you know, just basically told me, like, he gave me some pointers. He went back and watched one of my games. I did one specific game, Stanford Cal. And he gave me like 7 different clips of things that I could have done differently. And when he made the suggestions, I was like, man, I'd never thought of that. Like, why didn't I think of that? You know? And there were a few times where I was like, yeah, I definitely should have done this. And he's like, right, you know. So it's just nice to be able to have that kind of feedback from not only the broadcasters who helped me, you know, throughout, but to have a boss like him running events that you can go to, who's, you know, he runs every event at ESPN, but he literally took the time to watch my Stanford Cal game and break it down with me. And that's just, it just really is an incredible experience. And I've been so lucky to have so many people who are so great at what they do allow me to pick their brain and ask them for advice.
George, help our listeners understand how much communication is going on between the producers, directors, and you when you're in the booth doing play-by-play.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you're like an air traffic controller. I mean, there's constantly someone talking in your ear. And by the way, that's the same thing in the studio, too. You know, I was just hosting NBA Today, and that's kind of the thing because, you know, an element is coming, constantly coming, right? So, you know, every play, not every play has a replay on football, but it could. A lot of them do, you know, especially if there's like a a big run or a big pass play or a penalty. You're going to replay that. So you got to be ready for that. Last year, I won't be doing it this year just because I've got too much, I've got so much on my plate and they've got way better broadcasters working on it this year than me. That's for sure. But I did UFL last year and that was the most daunting thing I've ever done because it is literally like football mixed with NASCAR because everybody's mic'd up. The offensive coordinator, the defensive coordinator, the head coach, the players, and you're laying out, you're getting in, you're weaving in and out of all this stuff, and you're still calling the game. The access is incredible for UFL. I really enjoyed the experience. If you love watching like TV, UFL is definitely something to watch because of the experience and the access being so different. But it was also very helpful because once I got back to college football this past year after doing UFL last season, I was like, oh man, this is way easier than doing a UFL game. There is a lot of traffic. You're teeing up your analyst. You're making sure to have the conversation while also following what's going on. You also have a spotter there telling you what's going down because you can't see everything on a football field. So you need someone who's focusing on who's made the tackle while you're focusing on who made the catch. And so you're looking down at your board while he's pointing at who made that particular play. If there's a fumble, like you're doing hand signals as to, the play, because sometimes, again, you're so far up and far away that you're not able to see it all right away. And here's the other thing. Some of our games are done with a remote control room. So your monitor is not on time. It could be like a second behind. That's why that spotter is invaluable. That's the most important person in that booth with you as a play-by-play person, because he's going to make sure, or she is going to make sure you get that thing right. And I haven't even included the stats person who's handing over notes to you constantly throughout the game on individual plays, on historic situations, how many yards something went, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it is absolutely a lot of people and a lot of moving parts from the control room to in the booth. And, you're integrating the sideline person as well, which I obviously have an affinity for being a sideline person as well. So I want to make sure that he or she gets their storytelling in and we all weave it in. And it feels like one fun conversation while we're doing the game.
I'm curious, in your time doing play-by-play, if there's any call or moment that comes to mind as the one that you find the most memorable.
Oh, I'll give you one. It happened last year. It was Stanford against Louisville. So for me, and there's probably another one, but this one was a better game. Stanford-Louisville, this was actually the week before I did the Stanford-Cal game. And I was preparing for the game. So I'm preparing all week long, right? I'm trying to find every article on every player, every coach. I'm reading every media availability if I don't get it on video. And I'm trying to find just a nugget, right, to be able to discuss as many players as I can. Because I think what you're trying to do, particularly in college sports, is we don't know these kids for the most part. So you got to give me a reason as a viewer to be invested in these kids or the coach or whatever, right? So I try to find something. So in this Stanford game leading up to Louisville, I was listening to the Stanford official podcast, and they had their usual setup with the coach, and then they had a player interview always. And the player interview that week leading up to that Louisville game was the kicker. And I'm like, do I want to listen to 15 minutes of the kicker? Because, there's the stigma. I was, oh, he's a kicker, punter, whatever, But I said, I'm already here and I'm on this hike. This is what I do. I like to listen to these podcasts while I'm on a hike and then just kind of jot some notes in my phone. And I'm listening and my God, this kid, I believe his name is Emmett Kenny. His story was unbelievable. So early in his career, he's kicking and he's, his family went to Stanford and whatnot. So he's a legacy kid. And he's kicking against, I think it was Arizona State. I said it right on the broadcast, but I'm so far removed now that I don't remember exactly. But I'm pretty sure he was kicking early in his career, maybe as a freshman or a sophomore. His first real opportunity to kick in a game, and it's against Arizona State or whatever. He kicks the ball, but he shatters his hip. His hip was already, he had some sort of pain going into the game, breaks his hip after kicking the ball, and he tells this story about how he falls to the ground, and he asks the guy, the holder, he's like, did it go in? He goes, yes. And so anyway, then he has to rehab for a year or so, and he gets Wally Pipped by Wilt Hardy, who was the Stanford kicker who then got drafted by the Rams in the sixth round, who's now currently the Rams kicker. So he gets Wally Pipped, and this first season back is the first season he's actually the real kicker. He's not just like the guy, you know, kicking, you know, on occasion, right? That he. So I'm telling this story about this is his first full season as the kicker in his senior year on senior day. And by the way, the lead up to this is insane because Stanford is making these crazy plays. There's this ridiculous penalty that is a 15-yard penalty on Louisville that gets them closer to field goal range. Then they jumped off sides and got them even closer. So anyway, long story short, I'm telling the lead up, you know, at this 53-yard attempt or whatever it was, it would be the longest of his career on senior day. Here's what this kid's been through. He broke his damn hip. He got Wally Pipped. Now he gets this chance to kick the game winner as time is about to expire. He kicks it. He nails it through the uprights. I go bonkers on this call after the lead up, and it was the perfect story at the exact right time. And none of that happens if I don't make the right decision to say, let me listen to the last 15 minutes of this podcast. And that's a long way to say there is no such thing as enough preparation going into a game, because you never know when any of those stories will become relevant. And when I was listening to that, I was like, man, maybe he'll kick a game winner. And I'm like, probably not. This game's going to be a blowout. Louisville's a 21.5 point favorite. But the, you know, the sports gods aligned for me that day.
The kick is up. It's gone! Stanford with the walk-off! What an unbelievable moment for Emmett Kenney. 2.5 years, Orlando, he was out because he broke his hip.
And that preparation that went into that game is what let me nail that call. And I have never been more satisfied in a game than I was in that game, all because it was a crazy finish. And then I was able to punctuate it with that story for that kid on senior day with all that he had been through.
So obviously we've talked a lot about your career, but we also want to talk with you a little bit about what's going on out in Los Angeles. And obviously the Lakers have had a pretty nice run here, but now with LeBron out for at least a week, the loss, we're taping Tuesday, the loss Monday night to Brooklyn, is that starting to maybe take the wind out of the sails a little bit, or does the Luka magic, is it still going?
Well, no, the Luka magic is definitely still going. The city is always buzzing for these games in a way that we haven't seen in a long time here, maybe since early in LeBron's tenure here in Los Angeles. And look, this stretch was already going to be tough because they are literally playing 6 games in 8 days. And their March was incredibly difficult. They have the 4th toughest schedule the rest of the way. And the league schedules it that way for the star-laden teams, because that's when a lot of the primetime matchups happen on ABC. So, and by the way, TNT as well on Tuesday and Thursday nights and whatnot. So I think that plays a role in it. But without LeBron, it's going to be tougher for sure. But I think they understood that this wasn't going to be, you know, a 20-5 stretch like they just had, that they were going to find themselves in a situation that was going to be a little closer to 500. So I think that goes into it too. I think they're probably realistic. You want to win as many games as possible. And then lastly, I would say it could be, depending on how things turn out, a little bit of a blessing in disguise, because I think Luka could try to kind of find his own footing. He's played a little better of late, despite a not so great game against the Nets, he had kind of been playing better, and maybe that gives him a little more comfort as they move forward.
Does this mean now that the Lakers are legitimate NBA championship contenders?
Oh, yes. I don't think there's any question. I think that that is a small circle of teams. I think it's Boston. I think it's Cleveland in the East. And I would say in the West, it's OKC, Denver, and LA, and the Lakers, that is. I can make a puncher's chance case for the Warriors, who are playing very well right now. I think they're just outside that circle. You know, I have a lot of respect for Giannis and Doc, so I would say they're just kind of right behind the Warriors in that contention. But that's it, really. I still think Boston is the team to beat, and I think if there was a team that I had to pick to potentially beat Boston, and I think that can match up well against them, interestingly enough, it would be the OKC Thunder. Based off what I've seen, I've had them a number of times here over the last 6 weeks, and I've had them numerous times over the last 2 years, and I'm just a big Thunder believer. I've never seen a team this young understand the assignment as well as they do. They understand the pecking order. Most young teams that average 24 years old across the board, they all want to get theirs. They want to get paid. This team doesn't think that way. They know Shea eats first, and it's either Chet or Jalen Williams second, and then the role players star in their roles. And it's real. It's very real. And I think their head coach, Mark Daigneault, is an elite-level head coach. And if you don't think so, watch to see how they perform the rest of the way and in the postseason. I think if they're healthy, they could be hoisting the championships. Although, if I had to pick, gun to my head, I would still pick the Celtics if they're healthy.
Okay, I got to ask about this one. When you hear about the Luka trade, did you think it was a hoax?
Oh, there's no question. I'm doing a game the next day, Memphis Bucks, and I'm on the flight to Milwaukee. And I was watching the Lakers that night on my phone. And then after that, I'm like, all right, I'll just put on ESPN on my phone. And it was a college basketball game. I don't even remember what it was. My buddy texts me, who I'm in a fantasy basketball league with, and says, Luka for AD. And I thought he was just like hitting me up on like a fake trade in our league or something like that. And I'm like, is someone making that move in the league? In our fantasy league? And he goes, no, you idiot. Shams just reported it. And I was like, what? So I immediately removed the college basketball game and I go to Twitter and I'm looking at the Shams report and I'm like, oh, this can't be real. He's got to be hacked. So I start trying to text him. And as I'm texting him, the next alert comes in and it's him and it says, this is real. And it has the details. It includes the Utah Jazz for some reason and Danny Ainge getting, Hood Schifino from the Lakers. And I'm like, there's no way Danny Ainge is helping the Lakers get Luka Doncic. And there's only one first round pick. No way. This is totally Shams being hacked. So I text the news desk. And I had texted Windhorst, and I'm about to text Shams, and I get messages back that it's real. And I'm like, mind blown, right? So, yeah, it was wild. There's no doubt about that. It was wild. I stood up for 4 hours. I was up till 3:30 Central, you know, talking to people, texting with people, watching TV, watching Brian and everyone on TV and Shams on TV, listening to every podcast imaginable. The Hoop Collective, Simmons' podcast, everybody that went live, basically, at that point, I was listening to them all, and I'm still texting my friends and colleagues about this thing. Yeah, it was, honestly, it's going to be one of those days where I remember exactly what I was doing and exactly how it went down and what I was up to at that particular moment. It's going to be one of those moments in NBA history.
You know, the interesting thing about the Luka trade is it followed such a great night for the Lakers. They were playing pretty well even before they got him. Yeah. I think a lot of the credit probably owed to one of your former colleagues named J.J. Redick. So you worked with Redick the past several years, I'm sure, and you, I'm quite sure, are aware of the mockery that the Lakers received for hiring him. Oh, they hired a podcaster. They hired LeBron's friend. Did you feel when Redick was hired based on the work that you did with him at ESPN that he had the potential to have success in the league?
No question about it. I had never met someone more prepared to do anything basketball related than I'd met than when I met J.J. Redick. I have had the liberty of working with a lot of great people, okay? Hall of Famers, literally Hall of Famers, okay, in the broadcast industry. And I would say J.J. is right at the top in regards to preparation, in regards to the engagement that he would have in those coaches' meetings, in those production meetings, the level of detail that he wanted to go into on stuff. And, you know, look, I also knew that guys around the league respected him and players around the league respected him. You don't have a 15-year NBA career and guys don't respect you, okay? That's just not the case. And especially when you look at his career arc, right, where he didn't play very much early on and then became one of the best three-point shooters in the sport's history, okay, and became a real weapon for that team, worked into that because, again, it was not given to him early on in his career. And this was not the era where we're shooting, you know, 53s a game, you know, when he first came into the league and even when he was at his peak. And I just saw how guys interacted with him and the respect he commanded. And yeah, I knew right away. I was on LA radio and people were calling into the show and tweeting into the show, oh, you're just taking up for your buddy and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, guys, you really don't understand. And now everyone sees it. Everyone sees what the rest of us already got to see for the couple of years he worked at ESPN. So I'm not surprised at all. I love the guy. And by the way, I think he still understands the assignment when we come in there, right? He's incredibly helpful without revealing anything that, that would be hurtful for him and his team. But he understands what we're coming in there to do, which, by the way, all the coaches historically that have done that, you know, Stan Van Gundy, right? Like a lot of these guys, when you deal with them in these meetings, Steve Kerr is another great example. They get the assignment. They're in there to help you do a good broadcast. And I'm appreciative of that as well, because you never know, right? Like he could have just gone into coaching and said, yeah, bleep you guys. I'm worried about this. You know, I'm not going to be your ally anymore. And I think he's been a great sport about it. He's had some fun interviews, right? Like he had that one with Richard Jefferson and Ryan Rucco early in the year. He's like, I don't want to be on America. I don't want to be on with these guys anymore. And like rips the headset off. But yeah, there was no doubt that he was going to be great at this, in my opinion. And so there is zero surprise that he's this good at it.
All right. And, I do want to bring up some of the broader narratives surrounding the Lakers this year, beyond just the basketball, but the coverage of the Lakers. Charles Barkley's complaints about people talk about the Lakers all the time. But why are we talking about the Cavs and the Thunder? Well, you can just look at even the viewership from this past week for Lakers Celtics versus Nuggets Thunder. As someone who was in the NBA and in NBA broadcasting and working for ESPN, who Chuck was ripping, right? What can be done, if anything, to get people as interested in Nuggets Thunder as they are in Lakers Celtics?
Okay, and it's interesting because it's funny. I made a joke today on NBA Today after we had already done the Lakers early. By the way, we did them in the B block. We didn't do them in the A block. Our A block was OKC Denver today on NBA Today, as it was the day before. And then we eventually did the Warriors in the D block, the fourth block. And I made the joke when we were getting ready to talk about Steph's 4,000 threes that he's approaching. I said, oh, Chuck's going to get mad. We've talked about the Lakers and the Warriors now. And I love Barkley. Barkley has been incredibly kind to me over the years. And I hope that if he saw that, he got a chuckle out of it, because he knows it's met with love. I do think he has a point. J.J. Redick made this point a couple years ago about, you know, trying to teach the audience. But I love Chuck. Chuck also does a segment every so often called Who He Play For. Okay, so let's not get it twisted that, you know, it's not like they're always teaching the game either. You know what I mean? But again, I love Barkley because he's been incredibly kind to me throughout my career, and he could, you know, doesn't have to be. So I love Charles. I can't wait till he's on ESPN and he's one of the fools and idiots with us, with all of us. Okay. And we can all be fools and idiots together. But yeah, I think that, you know, a show like NBA Today does that. You got it. It balances out. It's a league show. It balances it out, right? Here's the stuff people definitely, the casual fans know. They know LeBron James. They know Steph Curry. They know these brands because these brands have been so successful. And we teach you about OKC and the Cleveland Cavaliers. By the way, look at ESPN's schedule over the last, you know, from January on. A lot of OKC and a lot of Cleveland. Guess who's heading to Cleveland this weekend to do the game against the Magic on Sunday, okay? So, and we flexed into that game, okay? So, and we flexed into a number of games with OKC and Cleveland. So, well, I understand Charles, you know, upset about a particular comment or whatever. I understand his point, but I do think that if you want to find, you know, Cleveland and OKC coverage, a show like NBA Today will find that for you. The Hoop Collective podcast with Brian Windhorst will find that for you. And, you know, SportsCenter will have that for you. So I just think that, you know, different talk shows are going to do what's best for them. But nobody, here's the thing. If TNT wasn't airing Charmed reruns after the Inside the NBA and they had a 24-hour sports network, they would have a lot of different variations of what we do. Shows that will cater to the more casual audience, right? Shows that will cater to the more diehard audience. You got to have a plethora of things there for the different sports fans to want to tune into, right? And I think that, that would be my rebuttal to that. I think there are shows that do that. And I think that we will continue to do more of that, whether it's on the event side and on the studio side.
Do you think that NBA coverage tended to something that LeBron has said and JJ has said? Do you think NBA media coverage is maybe too negative and not necessarily focused on celebrating the game enough? We've seen this debate throughout the year.
So I think there is some merit to that. And look, I don't want to pick on the inside guys because they are legends, right? And they're great and they're funny. I laugh every time I watch them. But, you know, they have, when it comes to LeBron and Steph, who have been the caretakers of this generation, I feel like they do talk well about them. But the things that stick out to me are jump shooting teams won't win the NBA championship. You know, the Lakers stink when they don't kind of stink right now. You know what I mean? Like those kind of comments are going to resonate because negativity sells. And I'm not saying they don't praise them as much as they say negative things about them. The problem is in 2025, in the days of aggregation and social media and 24-hour sports coverage on television, on the internet, that's the stuff that's going to stick out. So I think both sides have an argument here. I think what happens is we concentrate too much on the smaller vocal minority that is negative and seeps through. Because when you watch a broadcast, a game broadcast, for the most part, it's very rare that an analyst or a broadcast team is going to go super negative unless it's deservedly so. You know what I mean? Like, I was watching Suns Clippers last week on TNT, and I thought Stan Van Gundy, deservedly so, was going in on the Phoenix Suns because they looked listless out there, okay, against the Clippers. Now, they came back and won the game, so maybe they were listening to Stan. But they did look lethargic out there and weren't even trying, it looked like, on defense. So, you know, you call them out, you call them like you see them is what I would say. I do think athletes, though, because they live on the phone, you know what I mean? That they get this furnace blast of the negativity constantly in a way that Charles and Shaq and Kenny and these guys didn't, right? So I think that they're living two different realities. Like Charles and Shaq are remembering the days of, I don't know, Bill Plaschke or, you know, Stephen A. Smith as a columnist or Mike Lupica in New York writing about them. And these guys are getting it, you know, a thousandfold, 10,000-fold, a millionfold based on, you know, Phoenix Suns fan 9462, you know, tweeting at Kevin Durant or, you know, Lakers fan XO127 tweeting at LeBron, you know what I mean? And like, and then we amplify these voices that are that are saying things that are critical, and we are not amplifying the stuff normally that is pleasant and giving them their proper due. And that's just the unfortunate way the media works in 2025. So I do think the guys are right. The players are right to some extent. And I do think that, you know, Charles and those guys have a job to do. They have to be critical. We all have jobs to do. I just think the amplification of it via the internet is the big problem.
George, I've got to ask you about Hubie Brown, who just wrapped up his broadcasting career. You've worked with him a number of times, and you were in Milwaukee for his final game working radio. What kind of partner is he, and what have you learned from him over the years?
Unbelievable. I have never learned more about the game of basketball and life than being around Hubie Brown. And when you do a game with Hubie Brown, you know, it's old school, baby. You have dinner, you know, when you get to the city, you know, early dinner, like around 6, you know, 6:30. And Hubie just opens up and you just let him tell stories. And man, does he tell unbelievable stories. I mean, you're talking about a guy, again, his career in the NBA spans so long. We had the graphic on that game, and I did do it on radio while Mike and Lisa were doing it on TV. And we had that graphic where, I don't know, he's basically either coached against or broadcasted 80% of the entire league's history. Like, that's insane when you think about it. And honestly, like, the best part was always, like, you know, he'd always, like, ask me, like, funny, we started this talking about Around the Horn. He'd be like, he's like, I saw you in Around the Horn the other day. I like this topic. And, like, you know, he'd be like, just ask me about that, or just how my kids are doing and my wife. And, you know, we talk about so many things beyond basketball. And then just his ability to see stuff and storytell is still second to none. So I did a playoff game with him last year, first round, game one, Minnesota, Phoenix, and T-Wolves. And I'll never forget this. First half, Phoenix has the ball, Grayson Allen on the left wing, dumps it into the mid post to Kevin Durant, and defense kind of collapses. Durant, though, is still got the ball, and he's kind of like fidgety, and Hubie says, Durant needs Grayson Allen to move off, you know, without the ball. He's trying to get him back the ball so then they can either repost it or Allen can move the ball. And Allen's not moving like Durant wants him to. And, you know, they turn it over, I believe. Something to that effect happens. It, you know, and in the timeout, that's exactly what you heard in the huddle. And it was amazing. He's 90 years old and he's able to see it right there in real time. And, you know, that's the type of stuff you see. And, you know, the fact that he was still doing it and was so sharp for so long, we'll never see that again. Never. But I can't say any more about the human being and what an incredible wealth of knowledge he was for stuff both on and off the court.
You have blessed us with a full hour of your time today. I cannot express how appreciative I am of that. I do have one final question to kind of get you out of here on, and I'm curious, you've worked with a lot of folks over the years. Is there a single broadcaster working today, maybe even from the past, who you have never worked with, who would be the dream colleague to work an event with?
Ooh, I have a few. Here's what I'll do. I will give you a couple of iterations of it, okay? So if I was doing football, okay? This person could be dead or alive?
Yeah.
So if I was doing a football game, you know, if I could have worked with John Madden as my analyst, I mean, come on. You know what I'm saying? And then, like, our studio person, like Bob Costas, right? Actually, you know what? I'll use Costas for basketball. Studio person, Dan Patrick. I love my guy, DP. He's always so kind. He'll hit you up on occasion to check in on you. And, like, I remember one time I was going through it and I picked his brain on some stuff and he was incredibly helpful. But anyway, so DP would be my studio guy. John Madden would be my would be my analyst. And I would go, okay, see, I can play with this. On my sideline, I'd go Pam Oliver, okay, in football. So basketball, my analyst, man. My analyst would be the czar, Mike Fratello, the czar of the Telestrator, right? And the studio guy would be Costas, sideline Lisa Salters. And if I had to replace myself as a play-by-play voice on any of these, it would be Buck on football and obviously Mike Breen on basketball. And one more person I would love to work with that I've never worked with, Kevin Harlan. Again, I already mentioned earlier, incredibly helpful at times, along with all the people I've worked with and I mentioned earlier. But I'd love to work with Harlan because I remember doing, you know, Tracy McGrady and I worked together here at ESPN. We used to do the NBA show when it was The Jump. And I remember bringing him in my radio studio one time. And I said, are you like aware of like some of the insane calls that Kevin Harlan has had in your career? And he literally recited them to me. He's like, oh, yeah, he sucked the gravity out of the building and like yelled it like Harlan did. Like, so to me, like in like the NBA soundtrack of my life, and NBA is my number one sport, like my love, is in this order. It's Marv Albert, Mike Breen, and Kevin Harlan. And then I would say most recently I'd add to that as a member of my Mount Rushmore, you know, is Ian Eagle, because he's so good at what he doesn't, you can put Ian Eagle in any sport. He's as good as anybody. You know what I'm saying? So like, that would kind of be like, I left out a million people and that sucks. But those would kind of be some of my dream pairings and Mount Rushmores and people I would love to just have, you know, in my stable of broadcasters.
Did you ever get the Walton experience?
I did on TV when I was doing the Jump back then. We had a Wilt picture and he wanted the picture. No, it was Bill Russell. He wanted this Bill Russell picture we had hanging in the studio and he took it and replaced it by autographing the spot where the picture was. And it stayed there. That autograph stayed there as long as that set was in place. And then on radio, I mean, you know, the running joke is you'd ask Bill two questions and you'd be on for 30 minutes. So, yeah. And look, you want to talk about impeccable broadcasters. Dave Pasch, my guy, again, you know, not only a colleague, but a friend that I would call a friend. I mean, must see TV when he was doing games with Walton. Like when they were doing those Pac-12 games and I knew they were on, I told my wife, just sit back, watch this. You're gonna have a hoot watching this thing. And just the way Pasch navigated all of that, again, just shows what an impeccable broadcaster he is.
All right. And that will wrap up our conversation today. George, I can't, like I said before, a full hour of your time. Really appreciate it. Some great insights and great conversation. And we'd love to have you back sometime.
Anytime. Thanks for having me. And thank you guys for what you do. I think you guys do a great job informing the sports audience about ratings and, you know, everything that happens in regards to these shows that are on these networks and these events and how they rate. And, you know, the fact that there is someone putting in that work, I think is very helpful and useful. So I appreciate what you guys do, too.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you, George.
You got it.
All right. Well, what a great interview that was with George Sedano. I hope you all enjoyed it as much as Armand and I enjoyed bringing it to you. And that's going to wrap things up for the SMW podcast this week. Armand, thank you as always for joining me. We'll be back with more stuff down the line.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.